The following is provided through the IAAIS Program Share Service.
Hello and welcome to this week's World Traveler. I'm Leah Blackman with the Virginia Voice. Our first article is from A Woman's World, True Stories of World Travel. Women at the Well, Grace, Beauty, and the Power of African Women Emerge at the Traditional Gathering Place, by Mary Beth Simmons. One of the first stories I heard in Cameroon was the tale of the industrious Peace Corps volunteer who built a well in the middle of a small village. It seems the closest water source for the community was 5 miles away, a hefty one-way trek for himself and all the women who went to gather water each day. He contacted federal agencies in the States and Cameroon, routed out the necessary funds, and during a 3-month period, he and a band of local men constructed the well, a shiny testament to American pragmatism. Legend has it that when the well was completed, the volunteer broke a bottle of beer upon the metal structure, christening it before turning the spigot. As the water flowed freely, the people danced and drank from the convenient well, and most, it is said, never returned to it again. This troubled the volunteer. One day, when he saw his neighbor loading up her pushcart with empty water barrels, he approached with a simple question. Why was no one using the well he had constructed for the village? She was shy but honest, and told him the women continued to make the long journey for water because it was their time to be alone, to gossip, to laugh, to be only with women. When could they find long stretches of time to be away from their husbands when the new well was only a 5-minute walk from their compounds? With this, the volunteer was defeated but amused. For the new volunteer, such as myself, the story stood as a warning, a lesson, a gentle reminder. Before fixing a, quote, problem, unquote, found out first if it is indeed a problem. After a few weeks in my village, I became fascinated with simply watching women congregate at the well close to my home. The well legend had captured my interest in the activity of gathering water. But the women, the beautifully different women, held my true attention. Initially, honestly, the nudity at the well caught my eye, not because it was unexpected, as I had been told my village was very traditional. Women would often wear a pagne wrapped around their waist, and that was it. What impressed me was the evidence of heavy labor being performed by these half-clothed women. Their exposed upper torsos showed taut bellies, solid upper arm muscles, atlas-like strength. They could carry 20-gallon metal barrels on their heads without sloshing a drop over the sides. Their slender hips sashayed ever so gently, enough to create momentum for the walk home, but not enough to rock the balance. I once walked behind a woman and listened for her breathing, wondering if I could detect the strain under which she toiled. Her footsteps slapping the dusty ground were all I heard, coupled with the lazy lapping of water against the insides of the ceramic tub perched on her head. Though I was fascinated by their competence, I cannot simply dismiss the sheer nakedness of some of the women. I would be lying if I said the nudity did not stir something inside me. If anything, I was finally allowed to test my art appreciation skills, to at last discover if the female body was worth the adoration. I had channeled to it, and it was. What pleased me aesthetically was the difference. Before me were no curvaceous white beauties found in the works of the great masters. yet there was the grace and power of woman to appreciate. One older woman, well into her 70s, was particularly striking. Her sagging, wrinkled breasts at first were hideous, resembling well-worn leather billfolds, not a bosom. But when the sunlight caught dancing beads of water in her gray stubble head, and a friend came up from behind and touched her shoulder, her smile, her radiance in that moment was a beauty I could never have imagined. The richness of her deep black skin, skin the color of Midwestern soil, juxtaposed with the stark, parched landscape, amplified her presence. And as I drew closer, my heart ached for her, for the overwhelming burden she undertook with every gallon of water she fetched for her family. A lifetime of the brutal sun and suckling children had drained the suppleness from her body, leaving her ragged, but still gallantly standing. After she had filled her oversized bowl and lifted it to her head for the walk home, she stopped, removed it, and went to aid a friend struggling with her own heavy load. I was taken. If ever there was a moment when I've wanted to applaud spontaneously, it was then. But everyone would have detected my voyeurism. No longer would they have seen me as the nonchalant market shopper I hoped to resemble. I noticed my own presence in the scene. How disjointing it was and sad when I checked myself, when I mentally gauged my perversity for imagining what a kiss might be like from her. The older women of the village followed tribal custom by having a large button sewn into their mouths, directly above their upper lip, a sign of beauty, I had been told. And though it was captivating, a consistent focal point for me with the women, I could only picture them trying to kiss their husbands or lovers passionately. It seemed they had little control of their mouths. I watched them at the well drinking water from their cupped hands. They slurped from the sides of their mouths, rendering the center worthless, hindered by the obstruction of a bulky button between the nose and upper lip. How were these lips to form a kiss? The teenagers, free of the button custom, since it is no longer forced upon little girls, filled their mouths with water and chased each other around the well, spitting perfect streams into friends' backs and ears. Their pucker urged me to fill my own mouth, and as my fingers traced my lips, I grew thirsty. Never had water looked so refreshing. They drank it, played in it, collected in their barrels, all the while celebrating with an abandon I envied. As I watched them, I remembered a story a college professor once told me. When she was in her mid-20s, walking along campus on a warm spring day, she passed a bed of brilliant red poppies, and she knew the moment she gazed at them, it would be one of the final times she would recognize natural beauty. She called the experience an inner shift. She knew she was losing her grip on the richness and wonders of nature. Her life was transforming into a devoted investigation of the complexities of the world. Simple pleasures were losing their appeal. For me, my fascination with the women at the well acted as the antithesis of my professor's story. Watching the women awakened me. They helped me to fine-tune my belief in the power of sisterhood and urged me to ponder my own connection to basic elements of life, water, sunlight, physical labor, human contact. That was Women at the Well by Mary Beth Simmons. One day, while working on an organic carrot display at a natural food store, Mary Beth Simmons realized she wanted more. More meant the Peace Corps in West Africa, and more she got. After Cameroon, Mary Beth earned an MFA in nonfiction from the University of Iowa and is currently the Writing Center Director at Villanova University. Our next article is from NationalGeographic.com. Cameroon's embattled ebony trees get a lifeline from Guitar Maker. The guitar industry has a spotty track record for sustainable wood sourcing, but one manufacturer is trying to help stave off deforestation. By Tim McDonald, June 17, 2019. Wielding a machete, Noel Nikuli hacks a path through thick vines crowding the tropical forest outside his village in Kampia, in Cameroon's rural southeast. Every few yards, he digs a shallow hole in the rich red soil and plants the leafy sapling of an ebony tree, an iconic indigenous hardwood species with a jet black interior that is prized for sculptures, piano keys, furniture accents, and stringed instrument fingerboards. Since last year, Nikuli and his neighbors and a handful of other villages in the area have planted more than 5,000 ebony trees. The trees won't be mature enough to harvest for a century, but Nikuli sees them as an investment in future generations at a time when the forests of Central Africa are quickly disappearing under pressure from agriculture and logging. Their work is part of an ambitious reforestation effort supported by an unlikely patron. The American guitar manufacturer, who equips the likes of Taylor Swift and Jason Mraz and is among Africa's biggest commercial consumers of ebony. Taylor Guitars, which uses Cameroonian ebony to build fretboards and bridges for each of the 160,000 guitars it makes every year, has underwritten a unique coalition of local and international ecologists to fill critical gaps in the research on ebony ecology and to oversee the planting of up to 20,000 trees next year. The project aims to amend the guitar industry's spotty track record on sustainable wood sourcing. In 2012, Gibson Guitars, another top manufacturer, paid more than $600,000 in criminal penalties after the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service found it had illegally imported ebony and rosewood from Madagascar and India. And it has caught the attention of forestry experts at the World Resources Institute, the U.S. State Department, and the World Bank as a hopeful model for restoring the hardwoods that are one of the region's richest but most threatened natural resources. "These trees are our heritage," Nikuli says. "My parents' generation could cut trees freely and never worry about it. But today, we're realizing that if we don't plant trees, there may be nothing left for our children. We're very worried about the future of our forests in Cameroon." Fixing a rotten business. The Congo Basin is facing a rapid increase in deforestation. Cameroon is on pace to lose an area of forest the size of New Jersey by 2035, according to the Center for International Forestry Research. Forests are cleared to make way for palm oil, rubber, and cocoa plantations, as well as for small-scale slash and burn farms. Global timber markets in Asia, the U.S., and Europe are driving an increase in both legal and illegal logging. Meanwhile, China is helping Cameroon build a massive new deep water port that will make it easier to export trees from across the Congo Basin. But the country's forest management policy, starved of funding, lacking reliable data, and fraught with corruption, is not keeping pace with those threats, according to interviews with local and international researchers, forestry officials, and leaders of forest-adjacent communities. "What we have now is not sustainable, and that's why the forest is disappearing," says Samuel Nigufo, who directs the nonprofit Center for the Environment and Development and Cameroon's capital, Yaounde. What we get from logging is absolutely nothing compared to what we're losing. Ebony might offer a chance to reverse that trend. The ebony species found in the Congo Basin was first traded internationally by Portuguese colonists in the 15th century, alongside ivory and slaves. With a fine grain and natural luster, it was considered a gem among woods. But ebony tends to crack in large pieces, making it ill-suited for construction and furniture. Today, it accounts for less than 0.1% of Cameroon's timber exports. Still, ebony has always stood up well to abuse by the strings and fingers of guitarists, violinists, pianists, and other musicians. Bob Taylor is a San Diego-based woodworking guru who built a cult following and a multi-million-dollar company in the 1980s, after Neil Young started playing his handmade guitars, and has remained an industry kingpin since. In 2011, he heard about a rundown ebony sawmill for sale on the outskirts of Yaounde, and saw a chance to take control of a volatile supply chain. An individual high-end guitar can include half a dozen species of hardwoods, including exotic ones like ebony, rosewood, and mahogany, that are vulnerable to over-harvesting, climate change, and other threats. In recent years, Taylor says, these materials have become more expensive, harder to find, and more frequently subject to international trade regulations. The Gibson incident was definitely a wake-up call, Taylor says. Guitar makers never used to worry about where our wood came from, but now we're watching it all go away. After Taylor bought the Yaounde sawmill, it didn't take long to find that the local ebony business was rotten to the core. Demands for bribes to rural officials and police along the tree's path from forest to factory were routine. It was nearly impossible to trace the legal origins of trees arriving at the mill. And for each of the 300 or so trees that arrived every year, several were wasted, left in the forest to rot because the interior wood wasn't considered dark enough. So Taylor worked to refurbish the sawmill and crack down on shady sourcing. He met Tom Smith, director of UCLA's Congo Basin Institute, who had worked in Cameroon for decades and knew as much about its forest ecology as Taylor knew about guitars. They found themselves circling a shared quandary. The urgent need to regrow tropical hardwoods in the Congo Basin was hampered because scientists knew more about how to cut the trees down than how to grow them back. Smith and Taylor decided that, especially with the sex appeal conferred by its use in guitars, ebony could work well as a case study in developing new methods to restore the forest hardwoods. Guitars aren't going to cause the demise of the rainforest, but they're a way to bring people in and raise the importance of wood products, Smith says. The Ebony Project is an opening to develop more sustainable restoration efforts for rainforests writ large. How to grow ebony. Only female ebony trees produce fruit, and only during 1 month of the year. So any attempt to grow the trees at a large scale would need a more efficient means of mass reproduction. For that, Smith enlisted the International Institute of Tropical Agriculture, one of Africa's leading nonprofit research organizations. At an IITA lab in Yaounde, a team of plant biologists is working on techniques to grow tens of thousands of ebony clones in test tubes from tiny clippings of hand-picked mature trees. IITA scientists are working to better understand how ebony fits into the Congo Basin ecosystem through a survey of more than 1,000 trees across the country. They found that the fate of ebony is closely linked to mammal species like West African elephants and antelope that rely on the tree's fruits as a food source and act as seed dispersers. Those animals are often targeted by bushmeat hunters, meaning that poaching is a really underappreciated threat to the forest health. The survey has also yielded some good news. Since 1998, Diasporus cresiflora had been listed as endangered by the International Union for Conservation of Nature. But in 2017, de Blauw and his colleagues presented evidence to an IUCN panel, including satellite data that didn't exist in the early assessment, that there may be up to 30 million mature ebony trees spread across the Congo Basin, many more than were previously understood to exist. As a result, in March, the listing was upgraded to vulnerable, meaning that the tree's future is brighter in the Congo Basin than in countries like Madagascar and Sri Lanka, where other ebony species remain overexploited. Still, planting a few thousand trees won't save the Congo Basin forests if countries like Cameroon don't take more aggressive action to curb illegal logging and other threats, says Sean DeWitt, director of the Global Research Initiative at the World Resources Institute in Washington, D.C. It's a drop in the bucket, he says, but from the beginning, they've been focused on getting a replicable model so it could inspire other companies and other supply chains. For music lovers in the next century to enjoy the tones of high-quality wood instruments, Taylor says, the time to plant the trees is now. I want people to be able to play guitars like this in 100 years, he says. We have a chance to get it right in Cameroon. That was Cameroon's Embattled Ebony Trees Get a Lifeline from Guitar Maker by Tim McDonald, June 17th, 2019. Our next article is also from National Geographic. Some information about Cameroon. Cameroon in West Africa is a mixture of desert plains in the north, mountains in the central regions, and tropical rainforests in the south. Along its western border with Nigeria are mountains, which include the volcanic Cameroon Mountain, the highest point in West Africa at 13,451 feet. Cameroon is triangular in shape and is bordered by Nigeria to the northwest, Chad to the northeast, the Central African Republic to the east, the Republic of the Congo to the southeast, Gabon and Equatorial Guinea to the south, and the Atlantic Ocean to the southwest. Approximately 250 ethnic groups speaking about 270 languages and dialects make Cameroon a remarkably diverse country. The Republic of Cameroon is a union of two former United Nations trust territories, French Cameroon, which became independent in 1960, and Southern British Cameroons, which joined it after a 1961 UN-sponsored referendum. The rainforests in the south of Cameroon are home to screaming red and green monkeys, chimpanzees, and gorillas, as well as rodents, bats, and a great diversity of birds, from tiny sunbirds to giant hawks and eagles. A few elephants can be found in the forest and in the grassy woodlands, where baboons and several types of antelope are the most common animals. Waza National Park in the north, which was originally created for the protection of elephants, giraffes, and antelope, is full of forest and savanna animals, including monkeys, baboons, lions, leopards, and birds. After Cameroon became independent in 1960, the country began to prosper and the government built schools, helped farmers diversify their crops, and encouraged new types of businesses. The global sale of products such as cocoa, coffee, and oil helped boost the economy. This period of growth lasted for 20 years, until corruption and the decline in the value of exports caused the economy to go into a recession. Now Cameroon relies on international aid organizations, as well as the sale of petroleum and cocoa, to keep its economy stable. People with professional jobs usually grow and sell small amounts of crops. The economy depends a lot on the amount of money people can get from selling oil, tea, coffee, and cocoa. Because oil reserves may run out in the future, Cameroon is working to come up with other ways to make money. History. Tribes lived in Cameroon's highlands more than 1,500 years ago and began spreading south as they cleared forests for new farms. Cameroon's colonial name comes from the Camaros, or prawns, that 15th century explorers found in the Wouri River. Between 1884 and 1916, Germany united the southern and northern areas into a colony. Germany's defeat in World War I led to Cameroon's separation between France and Britain. The French tightly ruled the east from the capital Yaoundé. The smaller British area to the west was ruled more loosely from Nigeria. Independence was achieved in the French Cameroon in 1960. In 1961, voters in the southern portion of British Cameroon chose to join in a federation with the new republic. Those in the north chose to unite with Nigeria. Cameroon's former French and British areas kept separate educational, legal, civil service, and legislative structures until a 1972 referendum adopted a national one-party system along French lines. Facts about the capital of Cameroon. Yaoundé, spread over seven hills, is the capital of Cameroon. It is in the southern part of the country. The 20th century Notre Dame de Victoire Cathedral has a striking triangular roof. Nearby, in the Lake Quarter, the former presidential palace is home to the National Museum, with cultural exhibits such as masks and sculptures. The Mivog Betsy Zoo is one of the best zoos in West Africa. It's run by the British nonprofit Cameroon Wildlife Aid Fund. Almost all the animals, including gorillas and chimps, have been rescued from the bushmeat trade and poachers. One of the largest markets in Yaoundé, Mufindi Market, is situated in the center of the city. Vendors sell anything from clothing to food, and it is a great place to get a taste of how locals do things. Situated on the slope of Mont Febi is the Benedictine Monastery, one of Yaoundé's most popular tourist attractions. The religious institution has a museum that has a wide variety of Cameroonian traditional art collections. Home to more regional artwork, Musée of Hemi is a private residence that has English tours. Friendly owners who often invite guests for lunch, and amazing artworks that date back more than 900 years. The artworks include ritual and ceremonial masks, statues, and royal beds. Opened in 2000, the Blackitude Museum is an ethnographic museum in Yaoundé, Cameroon. The museum was created to preserve the remains of the artistic heritage in Cameroon. A member of the royal family carefully protected and preserved the collections of art objects, which were given to Cameroon by kings of different chiefdoms. That's all for this week's World Traveler. I'm Leah Blackman for the Virginia Voice. This program is also available on demand at www.virginiavoice.org.